The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
I think this book almost have some sort of an Arabian night structure, in which kind of telling a story is the only way you can keep surviving.
One of the things we fought our parents for is the right to do as we wanted to, the right to kind of sexual self-determination, then became problematic when you had the freedom to do exactly that.
In 1962, Edinburgh was buttoned up, Calvinist, and it didn't really find it easy to welcome culture. And along came a couple of guys who organised a writers' conference.
Okay, they're smaller and they live underground, but they still have indigestion problems. And they still don't get on holidays enough. So I think you can identify with them. And really what they are, in my mind, is humans in 50 or 100 years' time.
Hello and welcome to the Edinburgh International Book Festival. We hope that you'll join us over the next 2.5 weeks as we range around Charlotte Square Gardens where the festival is taking place. But if you can't make it in the flesh, don't worry, we'll bring the festival to you through daily podcast interviews with authors whom we'll be accosting in the nicest possible way as they leave the stage. Before I took the train north, I asked the director of the festival, Nick Barley, what the standout events coming up were for him.
Wow, that's one of those questions which I find very hard because there are so many fantastic events. Partly depends on what you like. But there are, lots of great names. And some, I'm delighted to say, for which there are still tickets available. So I suppose they're ones which are on my mind. So, for example, Zadie Smith, who launches her new book with us, there are a few tickets left for that. Man Booker Prize winners like John Banville, Howard Jacobson, and then fantastic international authors such as Joyce Carol Oates, the American writer. And then genre writers, China Mieville, who I really love. And then the Scottish writer James Meek, who's got his new book out as well. So it's a really amazing selection.
Yeah, because the name of the festival is the Edinburgh International Book Festival. So that emphasis on international, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's really important. I mean, it goes without saying that every literary festival takes place in a place. So, of course, we are a Scottish festival and we celebrate Scottish writers. But it really matters to us that during August, Edinburgh is the world's leading cultural city. And so it's an international stage. And the internationalness is a fundamental part of the festival's DNA. And this year, I think we have writers from 55 countries joining us in Edinburgh. So it's genuinely international.
So it's an amazing range of authors that takes up a 2-page index in the festival brochure. There's A for Andrew Motion, who's going to be talking about his follow-up to Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, Silver. But don't, whatever you do, call it a sequel.
In fact, I think the whole history of sequels is really enough to make you think that they pave the way to damnation for writers. And for a very simple reason, which is to say that a sequel that takes on its original at its own game, is entering into a competition that it's bound to lose. So don't do that. If you must interfere with an existing text, do it, I think, in a way which allows you a great deal of freedom. I've never used the word sequel in connection with this book. It's described in its subtitle as a return to. It's 40 years later. We do meet Mr. Silver, but he is on his way out. I mean, he's virtually a dead man. I mean, that's the only connection, really, that it has with the cast that Robert Louis Stevenson gives us. And from that, all kinds of freedoms and possibilities arise. I mean, it seemed to me, doing it, that Stevenson himself is very inviting of the idea that a sequel might be written. He leaves all the silver on the island. Long John Silver is allowed to escape at the end of Treasure Island. He leaves 3 Maroons on the island as the Hispaniola sails away. So what on earth happened to them? There's also a great deal to be said about the way in which the original plot of Treasure Island is a kind of mash-up, as we might say these days. But once again, I want to say that I didn't want to do this in a way which trod on the heels of, on the august heels of Stevenson himself too closely. But was something that kicked off from it, but was allowed to become something in its own right.
And then there's A for the Irish novelist Anne Enright, who came to our book club earlier this year to discuss her latest novel, The Forgotten Waltz, which sets a story of adultery in a world of financial boom and bust.
It helps if the novel is a very social novel,
yes.
Because marriage is a social institution as well as a personal contract. And so in the context of the place I was writing from, which was 2009 in Ireland, you think, well, yes, as the old order fades away, then people are faced with new choices. And all the things we fought our parents for, which is the right to do as we wanted to, the right to kind of sexual self-determination, then became problematic when you had the freedom to do exactly that. So it was a very good crux subject for society in transition. But also, I had been looking at boom writers because you're constantly hectored in Ireland, so why are you writing such miserable old books when you should be writing about Ireland now? And here we are back in the bog and everybody's dead and it's all awful. And why are you not writing about contemporary Ireland? So you think, well, what is it about a boom? Anyway, I just thought it was a very good subject for a boom on the grounds that no one could afford it in Ireland before 2001. and it seemed to be the right subject for the time.
In Anne's book, the position of the child affected by events out of her control is often given equal weight to the adult experience. Another writer coming to Edinburgh is the New Yorker Ben Marcus, in whose Flame Alphabet, it's the children's language that's making the grown-ups ill.
In the months before our departure, most of what sickened us came from our sweet daughter's mouth. Some of it she said, and some of it she whispered, and some of it she shouted. She scribbled and wrote it and then read it aloud. She found it in books and in the mail, and she made it up in her head. It was soaked into the cursive script she perfected at school, letters ballooning with heart-dotted eyes, vowels defaced into animal drawings. Each piece of the alphabet that she wrote looked like a fat molecule engorged on air, ready to burst. How so very dear. The sickness washed over us when we saw it, when we heard it, when we thought of it later. We feasted on the putrid material because our daughter made it. We gorged on it, and inside us it steamed, rotted, turned rank. She did it without thinking, and she did it to herself, and it was we alone who were sickened. But of course, we'd find out it was others, too. Others, and others, and others.
As well as the regular festival, this year Edinburgh is playing host to the World Writers Conference. I asked Nick Barley to explain what that was all about.
Yeah, the story starts back in 1962, when Edinburgh's festivals were just really getting going, and when the world, I suppose, was in a kind of post-war condition. In 1962, Edinburgh was buttoned up, Calvinist, and it didn't really find it easy to welcome culture. And along came a couple of guys who organised a writers conference. And they invited some Scottish authors, such as Muriel Spark and Hugh McDermott. And alongside that, they invited international authors, such as Norman Mailer, William Burroughs. And now, these guys, obviously, they're legendary names now, but back then, they weren't that well known. William Burroughs was totally unknown in Europe. And they started talking, they asked questions about the novel and fiction and what it's for. But they were talking about taking drugs and about homosexuality in an Edinburgh which was totally shocked by this. And it became incredibly notorious, this conference, and it launched the career of Burroughs, and to a certain extent it boosted the career of Norman Mailer as well. It also then made possible the Scottish literary renaissance, which has led to the likes of James Kelman, Irving Welsh, and so on, having such success. And so 50 years on, I wanted really, first of all, just to look at the impact of this amazing 1962 conference and all the myths around it. But I also thought that the questions they asked back in 1962 remain relevant today, even though obviously the context is totally different. Back then they were in a post-war condition. Now we are in a globalised world, in the information age. But the question about what fiction is for and the relationship between fiction and the world we live in obviously remains the same. And so what we decided to do was to put on another conference in which 50 writers from all over the world are invited, but the public are invited to come and join them. to talk about what fiction means in today's world and to try to create a kind of snapshot of the novel today, what it means.
It sounds absolutely fascinating to me. Can you tell us a few of the people who are going to be involved?
Yeah, so it's a really great international lineup. Each day there's a keynote speaker who's been invited to produce a polemical opening statement, which is supposed to kick off the discussion. On the first day, this is an international day, which looks at the relationship between literature and politics. We've got Ardaf Suef, who is the Egyptian writer. She was a Man Booker nominee, but she was also very heavily involved in the Arab Spring uprisings of last year. And so she's a novelist who's been deeply involved in politics. She'll be talking about the relationship between literature and politics in an event which is chaired by the amazing Turkish novelist Elif Shafak, who may not be so well known in the UK, but she's got a million Twitter followers in Turkey. You know, she's a household name there. So we go from that sort of extremely international position to a British position. We've got keynote speakers who include China Mieville. We've also got Irvin Welsh giving a keynote speech on literature and national identity. Chairs include Ian Rankin. So it's I think, a really nice mixture of the British and international speakers. And they're all very feisty, intelligent people.
You've said that there are tickets still available for some of the events at the festival proper. What about people who wanted to come to the Writers' Conference? Is that still possible?
There are still a few tickets available for that as well, yes. So I think the opportunity for people to rub shoulders with 50 really extraordinary writers from around the world, I think there's a little piece of literary history in the making here. The main web address is edbookfest.co.uk. Start there and the rest will be easy.
One of those coming to Edinburgh who has had to question his role as a writer is the Israeli Edgar Keret, author of Suddenly a Knock on the Door. He's just come back to writing after years of a block, which led him to spend his time making films.
I made more money. I spent more time with the child. Everybody seemed to be very happy about the fact that I don't write stories, you know? It was like kind of this kind of an alcoholic who stopped drinking, and everybody said, wow, you know, he's so nice since he stopped writing stories. And yet it bothered me. I had a strong urge to write, and I was unable to write the way I wanted to. And I think that quite a few of the stories in this collection deal with the fact that, why the hell is it so important for me to write? What is the function of writing fiction in my life? Why is it so crucial for me? Because I think this book almost have some sort of an Arabian Nights structure, in which kind of telling a story is the only way you can keep surviving. Telling a story or writing fiction helps you kind of make sense out of some sort of an arbitrary reality around you. You know, if you give me three facts, I can connect them in the story, and it suddenly, there is a reason for the violence, there is hope in tragedy. I just need to juxtapose those three things in a certain way, and suddenly there's hope, you know. Tell the truth, the most childish thing about writing, that, you know, it's like many times I have this urge, I want to call my wife and say to her, take the kid and get out of the house, do it now, like they do in the movies, you know. But I really don't want people kind of to explode my house, you know, in the next scene, you know. So writing a story gives you this benefit, like you can do things without dealing with the consequences.
Never any problem with writer's block for the veteran Michael Frayn, who'll be in Edinburgh talking about farce. A polymath writer, his work ranging from journalism to television, he's currently best known as a playwright, since his Noises Off revival retook London by storm. It wasn't always easy, though, he told Andrew Dixon.
Well, I've written comedies that have gone in front of an audience and they haven't laughed, yes. I'm extremely worried. Comedy is quite brutal in that way because with a tragedy, if the audience appear to be absolutely silent, not responding, you can always say, well, they're very moved inside themselves, they're just not showing it. But the comedy, if no one's laughing, it's just not funny, and there's nothing you can say about it. You just haven't got it right. And I've certainly written comedies that haven't worked. I was going to say, you said I've written different sorts of comedy. I've written two different sorts of comedy. I've written comedies that have made people laugh and comedies that haven't made people laugh.
I mean, people might not know that there's a kind of successor to Noises Off called Look, Look, which was a flop, wasn't it?
Absolute catastrophe, yeah.
You've had this extraordinary career. You started as a journalist, you wrote novels, you've written plays. Have you ever had a sense that you always wanted to do all of that.
So I always knew I wanted to be a writer, but I was extremely unclear what writing was going to involve, and I certainly didn't always want to write plays. You know, I just despised the theatre. A producer called Alexander Cohen, a New York producer, who was working in London on this occasion, was producing a show, a series of short plays about marriage, and the director rang me. I'd worked with him on television, and he rang me and asked me if I would write a one-act play about marriage to go into this. Well, it's very difficult to refuse a challenge, however much you despise the thing. If somebody says, can you do this? I immediately sort of set to work trying to do it. So I handed him my short play, which was a very naive piece about a young couple who go back to the hotel where they spent their honeymoon a few years later for a nostalgic return visit. Only now they've got a baby, and it's about the difference that children make to your life. And the director rang me a week later and said, I'm terribly sorry, but the producer says he can't do this, it's too filthy. And the director said, yes, Alex says he could never do a play in which a baby's nappy is changed on stage.
The first to die was Protesilaus, a focused man who hurried to darkness with 40 black ships, leaving the land behind. Men sailed with him from those flower-lit cliffs where the grass gives growth to everything. Pyrrhus, Iton, Teleus, Antron. He died in midair, jumping to be first ashore. There was his house, half built. His wife rushed out, clawing her face. Podarcus, his altogether less impressive brother, took over command. But that was long ago. He's been in the black earth now for thousands of years. Like a wind murmur begins a rumor of waves, one long note getting louder. Like a land ripple, when the west wind runs through a field, wishing and searching, nothing to be found, the corn stalks shake their green heads. Like a wind murmur begins a rumor of waves, one long note getting louder. The water breathes a deep sigh. Like a land ripple, when the west wind runs through a field, wishing and searching, nothing to be found, the corn stalks shake their green heads. Echepolis, a perfect fighter, always ahead of his men, known for his cold, seed-like concentration, moving out and out among the spears, died at the hands of Antilochus. You can see the hole in the helmet just under the ridge where the point of the spear pressed through and stuck in his forehead, letting the darkness leak down over his eyes. Elephenor from Euboea, in command of 40 ships, son of Chalcodon, nothing is known of his mother, died dragging the corpse of Echepolis, a little flash of flesh showing under the shield as he bent. He wore his hair long at the back. Like leaves, sometimes they light their green flames and are fed by the earth, and sometimes it snuffs them out.
Alice Oswald, who's one of my personal favourites, will be reading the whole of her poem Memorial in Edinburgh. It was inspired by Homer's Iliad and first performed at the Poetry Prom in Aldborough. Now let me remind you that this festival is also for children, with a wealth of jolly authors to meet and events to get involved in. Among them are two we've brought into our studio this last year, Ali Kennan, who recently published Bullet Boys, and Owen Colfer, who's just brought out his final Artemis Fowl volume, The Last Guardian. One of our children's panel put the following question to him.
Again, Book Addicted Girl says, of all the fairy books I've read and all the various types of fairies in them, Artemis Fowl is still my favourite series and definitely has the coolest fairy folk. How did you come up with the fairies and the world? Was it based on mythology?
Yes, it is based on the general idea that 10,000 years ago, all the fairies of the world had been kind of herded into Ireland by the humans. It's a bit like the American reservations where they herded all the Native Americans into one area and they all had to stay there. Well, all the fairies were herded into Ireland. And then even that wasn't enough. So the humans came to Ireland to fight the fairies. And there was two huge battles, the battles of Tailte 1 and 2. After the second one, the fairies couldn't win. So their magicians bored a tunnel under the ground to this magical realm, Tir na n Og. I'm sure maybe you've heard of that. But that's all the information you got, really. There's never any stories about what happens under there. What is it like under there? So I began to wonder, well, okay, if they're under there and they've survived, if it's to be believable, they must have amazing technology just to breathe. And it developed from there. So I decided, rather than make them cutesy fairies, you know, who flit around and give wishes with magic wands, that they would be very technologically advanced fairies. And once I had that idea, everything sprawled from there.
Well, the Pink Elephant wants to know how you managed to merge this supernatural fantasy world with the modern world while still making it believable.
I'm glad that the Pink Elephant is real, because I thought it was just me who saw that. I was very influenced by a movie called Blade Runner there, where even though it's amazingly technologically advanced, it's for them, it's old. So it's not all shiny and new. It's an amazing thing they have, but it's really old and doesn't work half the time. And so I made the fairy world broken down. A lot of stuff doesn't work. They still have the same problems for females in business. Holly can't get past the glass ceiling. She's the first girl to be a captain, and that's as high as she can get. So they have the real problems that humans have. So even though you can't identify with them as a species, underneath that, you can identify with them as people. So you might have some of the problems that they have. So it doesn't seem so alien now. It's okay, they're smaller and they live underground, but they still have indigestion problems and they still don't get on holidays enough. So I think you can identify with them. And really what they are, in my mind, is humans in 50 or 100 years' time. So underneath all the technology, they're just people. And that really helps the readers to identify with both camps.
Bullet Boys is about three lads. It's about Max. He's a bit of a loner. He gets into a lot of trouble, doesn't get on with his family. He's just been expelled from his very posh private school for dastardly deeds. It's about Levi. He's a very shrewd, happy-go-lucky sort of chap, but he's the glue that holds it together. He's a very sociable fellow. And it's about Alex, who's this gamekeeper's son. He's cool and sexy and crackshot, and he's a lovely fellow. Anyway, these lads live on the outskirts of Dartmoor. And they keep brushing up against and coming into trouble with a group of young trainee soldiers. Anyway, these lads, they find a cache of terribly terrifying buried things. I can't tell you what until you've read the book. On the moor, they find this deadly secret. The book ends up in a terrifying manhunt across Dartmoor. Imagine being chased across the moor by armed soldiers in your socks. It's Bullet Boys.
So those are just some of the delights we have in store for you over the next 2.5 weeks. Check in every day for a new interview, and do come and say hello if you're on site. Until tomorrow, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.